Hey, folks, my name is Tommy T. I'm an alcoholic. You guys take this stuff pretty serious up here. I like it. You know, a young man in the front asked me, do you get nervous before you speak? And I said, nah. Then I looked at all the double-digit sobriety in the room, and I'm just going to ask you guys not to judge me too harshly. And to that young lady with 4 days, listen up. All right? So it's all good stuff. Great sobriety countdown. That's what it's all about. And, you know, one of my favorite lines, and you'll probably hear me say this about 3 or 4 times because I love the big book, but it's as true for the lady with 4 days and the gentleman with 47 years. Thank you for being here when I stumbled in. The greatest days of our existence lie ahead. And it's so true. My sober date is April 8th, 1995. I didn't come to you folks because I wanted to. I came with the help of the NYPD, a few sympathetic judges, a couple of ex-wives, and a mother and father that didn't know what to do with me. And, you know, we don't come here because things are good, right? So, you know, it's been a long journey, and it's been a great journey. And part of the joy that I have is coming out and doing some of this stuff. And I'd like to thank all the home group members who cooked and did all that service. That's great stuff. Great stuff. I always enjoy eating things that I don't really know what they are, and it was just all very tasty and very well served. And I'd like to especially thank my friend Alex, who told me to tell you that he's the founding member here, and for inviting me up. It's very important that you know Alex is responsible for bringing me here. So if I should say anything that offends you or goes against your beliefs here in Alcoholics Anonymous, please see Alex after the meeting. And, you know, of course, if I touch you on any level, come up and let me know. I need all the help I can get. So it's all good. But, you know, what's amazing is the diverse group of folks that we always get at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Yet, when we walk in these doors, the nonsense of politics, the nonsense of race and religion go out the door, and we extend our hands and we open our homes, and we just want to help because we know how broken you are when you get here. And we've all experienced that. And it is the great fact of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're kind of like that movie, The Sixth Sense, where that little boy says, I see dead people. We see it every day at our home groups, right? Folks walk in, they got that half a cup of coffee, they're jiggling, they're looking down at their boots, and the lights are out. You know, they don't have to raise their hand to tell us we knew. We know. We get it. You know, you need a car, you need a girlfriend, and an iPhone. But no, you need a big book and a sponsor, you know. That's what you need. And but we get it. We've been there. If I only had that girl, I could stay sober. Sorry, can't help myself. And the vape. You got to have the vape, too. I'm sorry. So, you know, in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth tells us men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And man, when I read that, I said, wow, that's true. But I think if I was to put a little Tom T spin on that, it would make more sense to me if it said Tom drank because he couldn't handle the effect produced by life. You know, I mean, way before I picked up my first drink, I didn't feel right. I come from a small family. A father that drank excessively, a mom that started to join him because she couldn't beat him any longer, a sister who was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and even at that small dinner table, you know, I kind of felt different. I kind of felt like I was alone, kind of felt like I didn't fit. I mean, my sister used to tell me I was adopted. Maybe that had something to do with it, but, you know, it never clicked for me. I find this world a very hostile place, a place I don't fit in, a place I try like hell to fit in. I'll try to act any way I think you want me to act so you'll like me and so that I won't stand out and that you won't know how afraid I am inside and how strange I feel all times, even when I was drinking. I go to a crowded bar, I can go to a bar with this many people in it and still drink alone. I've always had that sense of isolation. And it gets to be a barren place. It gets to be an unsustainable way to live. And I hung on as long as I could, but I found alcohol at about 11 years old, and I had a spiritual experience with booze. I had a transformation that was suitable to change the way that my outlook on life, and it was awesome. I think it was 1970. A couple of my friends, we went down, we could forge notes from our mothers or fathers, and we'd say, please give Tom 3 quarts of Miller beer and a pack of cigarettes, and they'd go for it. You know, it was not a big deal. It was a pretty trusting world back then. You younger folks, the courts, they came before 40s, you know, and so we got some advice from a junkie on the corner, and he said, get straws with it, drink it warm, get you messed up quicker. So we said, oh, we'll follow that guy's advice, you know. And you come in here, and a guy with 25 years tells you, get a home group, get a sponsor, get yourself a big book before you leave tonight. You're like, nah, I got this. But that junkie on the corner that still lives at home with mom and dad, that's my mentor, you know. So, you know, I'm going to date myself a little bit. We went down, the hot record of the summer was Neil Young, Harvest, and I had a boombox, remember them? 8-track player, you know, and we were singing The Needle and the Damage Done at the top of our lungs, and we took caps off the beer, I threw mine away, I started chugging, and strange thing happened. I noticed that I drank a little differently than my friends, right off the bat, first time drinking. They started putting their caps back on the beer when they were about halfway through. And I'm like, what are you doing? They said, it's Friday night. We're going to save it for Saturday. I said, we'll get more Saturday night. I'll write another note. What do you mean? I'll steal a little more money. What's the big deal? They're like, no, you got to take it easy. I said, well, I threw my cap away. What are we doing here? Come on, let's get loaded, you know. And so I guzzled mine, and I pushed the kid down. I took his. I drank his. That was the smaller of the two guys. I went after the smaller guy first. Bad choices right out of the gate, you know. So by the time I went to get the other guy's beer, I was a little drunker, and he threw me a beating. I woke up. My boombox was missing. I had thrown up on myself. I had a cigarette burn. I didn't smoke cigarettes at the time. I don't know how that happened. And I woke up. It was about 2:30 in the morning. I was supposed to be home at 10:30. And I did what I've done my whole life after that in my drinking career for 23 years. I played alcoholic 20 questions, right? Trying to fit in, not letting people know that I black out, but I want to try to fill in the items that happened during the night. You know, hey, did we have fun? Where'd you guys go? Anybody know where my radio is? You know, kind of stuff, you know. And I've done that my whole life. You know, anybody get hurt? Right? Did we kill anybody later on driving the cars? Right? You don't know where the car is in the morning. So, you know, the 70s and going into the 80s, it kind of came up to a big weekend for me. I went out one night, I came back, and I was 35. I don't know what happened there. You know? So, I've had many great people trying to help me along the way and tell me to calm down and, you know, you drink abnormally, you do other things abnormally, and I was like, I don't know, man. If it's good and it's worth doing to excess. That's just the way I roll. If you're not going to put everything out on the table, if you're not going to come to drink until you pass out, I'm not your guy. You know, if you want to get really loaded, let's hang out. Once I start, I can't stop. I knew nothing about a phenomenon of craving back then, but many therapists and many good psychiatrists and many good priests and deans of schools, and they all tried to explain things to me, but it just didn't come across. And I got in the middle of the punk and new wave scene at New York City, and I was playing in bands, and that was just about trying to get as loaded as you possibly could and be like a Weebles Wobble, but don't fall down kind of thing with your bass guitar, and it was the coolest thing in the world, you know. I woke up many places, not knowing where I was, not knowing who I was with. Cracked up like 9 cars in 7 years. I actually had the last 2 cars I had Velcro on the plates, and the inspection sticker was done by tape, so you could take it off and put it on another $50 car, you know. And insurance was not a necessity back then; it was an option, you know. And did that for quite some time. And I got my second DWI. I think there's many nuisance arrests along the way. And I tried different ways to stop. I tried to just drink beer, and that paragraph that's in the big book, I've done everything except for, like, take a trip, don't take a trip. I always took trips, so, you know. But everything else in that paragraph, I've tried. And nothing worked for me because I have a mind that'll tell me it's not going to happen that way again. The mentality that keeps us from putting that our hand on a stove doesn't work for me with alcohol, although alcohol burns me every single time. See, because every, say, 25th time,
I won't get in any jackpot. So that'll say, see, you're making too big a deal of this stuff. You got this. This is all right. And after a DWI, I did like my second or third alcohol awareness course. I have 4 diplomas from that course now. I think I could teach it down at the local hospital on Staten Island. But I just didn't get any of it. And the people that were, they tried their best to give me what they had, but they weren't one of us. So I didn't want to hear it. If you learned it in a book, you couldn't tell me what it was like to be the son of an alcoholic, to be an alcoholic, to have these mental thoughts and my mind racing all the time. You couldn't possibly learn that in a textbook. And I saw through that stuff right away. So I didn't give much credence to anything anybody was saying to me. And Lord knows they were saying it to me. My parents sent me everywhere possible to try to get help. And I saw some of my friends graduate in college and getting married and things like that. And I said, well, you know, maybe if I get married, that'll help this out a little bit. I'll keep busy and I'll just work real hard and, you know, raise some kids and all. So I got my girlfriend pregnant. And, then I got married while she was 8 months pregnant. And I didn't have the order the right way, you know. But and I gave that woman the best 6 weeks of my life. And I ran on commitment and responsibility like the coward that I've always been. I can't do that stuff on my power. It's just not within me. So I didn't get to see my son for about 7 years. And how does an alcoholic like me handle that? You get twice as drunk on Father's Day, 3 times as drunk on Christmas, and you just blame that woman for everything in your life. You don't understand. If you had a father like me, if you had a wife like me, you'd drink like I do too. And as long as I had somebody to blame it on, I was quite comfortable with that. Except for when I was by myself. And I'd get little glimmers of truth. And I'd realize that that was just another one of my double-figured acting jobs where I could tell you that it didn't bother me. It ripped my heart out. Ripped my heart out that I ran away on a kid. Ripped my heart out that I was not capable of supporting a family. Was not capable of being a stand-up guy. I thought I was a stand-up guy. You know, the way the street teaches us to be a strong stand-up guy. I've learned a lot of different things here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And almost everything that I came in here with was absolutely 100% wrong. The real guy is the guy that's getting up and go to work and raises those kids and loves those kids no matter what. I just wasn't capable. And it's a tough thing, even now, to remember. And my son's back in our lives, and he's sober 2 years now. It's awesome. It's not so awesome he's back in our house, but what are you going to do? You know, we love him to death, but he's 31. He's got to get the hell out. I hope Brett doesn't go on the website. That would be a little tough. So we love our boy. We love our boy. Running out on the kid and doing everything, and I landed a good job with the city of New York as an engineer, and things were really going great, and I love that paragraph. And I think it's there is a solution where he talks about there wasn't a cloud in the sky. Everything was going well. See, I can get sober for a few days and make that court appearance and lie to that attorney and even go back to the ex-wife and get back in the house so I can steal some more money to go back out. I can put the pieces together real good, but man, you give me some good fortune, I'm dangerous. I will pull that down on my head with a senseless bunch of sprees, like the book tells us, and I will screw everything up that's good in my life every single time. And I did that. I got this job, and I knew that once I started this new job, that people didn't really know me. I hadn't drank for 3 years. I was doing other things. I tried sobriety using pharmaceuticals, and that didn't work out well, but I thought I was sober. In 1990, I took a trip to Jamaica. I went to a place called Hedonism. Figured I'd just go down and play with a little bit of ganja. And I was drunk on a plane. They offered 3-run punch. I started a fight for a guy for his Hawaiian shirt. I changed into the airport. I wasn't even on sand yet, and I'm dancing with the Welcome Back to Jamaica girls in the airport. I haven't even been there yet. Instant asshole, just add alcohol. That's me. And I went on a tear. And then I came back, and the funny thing is, after all the jackpots I'd been in my life, the thought never occurred to me, I have to stop again. The thought that occurred to me was, how am I going to drink and not get in the jackpots? What am I going to do? How am I going to function in this new job, in a professional job? I'll only drink at home. I won't go out to the bars anymore. I'll only drink on Super Bowl, weddings, wakes. Oh, wait, dart nights Tuesday night. Oh, no, there's a shuffleboard bowling tournament up at the bar. I got to go to that. Right out of the gate, I'm going again. And it was a horrible, horrible time. 1990 to 95 was the roughest time for me, because if you're like me, it's all or nothing. So when I start to try to count drinks or don't do other things or bridle or fetter my drinking in any way, shape, or form, it's just a nightmare. It's a nightmare, and it's constant in my head. So I would go up to an old man's bar in my neighborhood, and I'd sit down, and I'd have a shot and a beer. It was a 75-cent shot of Jack Daniels, 25-cent beer. I'm drinking with guys that are 65 years old. I'm 30, and I'd sit there and pound them down. We'd have arguments about sporting events they were at. I wasn't even born at, but I'd swear I knew more than they. And if it got out of hand, I'd just beat up an old man. It was no big deal. And this was the type of drinking I was doing at 30 years old. And, you know, if a young lady would come in the bar, I'm your guy. You know, if she needed directions or was just down on her luck, I'm that shoulder to cry on, honey. I'm here for you. My next competition was 35 years my elder. If I couldn't pull this off and pick up a woman in this bar, you know, it's pretty much time to hang up the cleats. You're not on the team anymore, you know. And so a woman would come in, and I would stop drinking. We'd grab a six-pack. We'd go back to my apartment. I'd wake up the next day. I'd remember that girl's name. My car would be outside. I'd still have a couple of $100 from payday. I got this. This is good. I would take her out to breakfast and drive her home, because I'm that kind of guy. So then my mind would start spinning. You're not that bad. You can go out again Saturday night. Nothing happened last night. You got lucky, for crying out loud. So I'd go up to that same bar. I'd have that same Jack Daniels, that same beer. But no woman would come in. So I'd close that bar. And then I'd start going to, Bill calls them, the most sordid places on earth. And I knew where they were. Believe me, I knew every secret knock and everything else you had to do to get in. And I'd wake up, it'd be Tuesday. I don't know where I am. There's a transvestite next to me in the bed. Hey, it happens. What can I tell you? My car's missing. And then I go, oh, wait, I have some money left. And I go in my pocket because there's some paper there. And no, that's three ATM slips. I wiped out the bank account, too. I can't even pay my rent now. And that went on for 5 years, not knowing when Friday was going to happen or when Saturday was going to happen. So if Saturday happened, what would happen? I would stay away from it for 60 days, but my mind would spin on me. That mental obsession would kick in to such a level that it was torturous. You had to have something to quiet the mind the way I was. I would never, ever sleep without something in my system. I would put my head on that pillow and just toss and turn all night. It was torture. I'd wonder, why am I always tired? I'm plotting revenge on people. I'm going to kill people. I'm going to have a fight tomorrow. This never occurs. But this is where my mind goes. Where am I going to get the next drink? When am I going to go back out? When am I going to do this? It is just a constant, constant show up there. And it's a busy circus. And it is my circus. It is my monkey, right? I mean, it's just, it's a very loud place. On April 6th, 1995, I went out for a couple drinks with some friends. And it was just a typical, no girl came in the bar night. And I ended up running around Staten Island at some point in the evening. See, I was a real sharp drunk back then. I would, like, put half of my pay home so I'd have money for rent. That would just make me drive really drunk, really fast in the middle of the night to go get more money to keep drinking. And I must have put a loaded handgun in my belt, because that's why I'd arrested, but I had a gentleman in the car that I picked up in after hours. He's doing life for murder. I think up here somewhere, for crying out loud. They send them all up this way. We got arrested, and my detox was the Brooklyn House of Detention. I spent 4 days there with 30 men in a cell, and I was even different in that cell. Playing 20 questions with the CO. What are the charges? What did I do? Did anybody get hurt? 23 years had elapsed, but I'm still playing that blackout 20-question game. The other guys in there, they were hardened criminals, a lot of them, and they knew exactly why they were in there. I didn't even know that, so I don't even fit in prison. And And I'm afraid in prison. I got to put on that tough guy thing, and you close that door behind me. Sissy Mary, right here, this is me. I don't do it well. I didn't do 4 days well. I actually had resentments that my parents didn't bail me out quick enough. Can you imagine that fourth step? Craziness, craziness. So I did not come here willingly. I came here broken. I came here $38,000 in debt to drug dealers and bookies and loan sharks and bars. My life was a mess. If a car backfired when I first walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would dive over the hedges because I thought somebody was taking a pot shot at me. I'm kind of envious of folks that can go to a six-month rehab, come out and get in a halfway house, maybe get a little assistance, take a couple of VESID programs, a couple of culinary arts courses. They wake up, what meeting am I going to go to, the 10 or the 10:30? It's not my experience. It was not my experience. I had an ex-wife that came out of the woodwork while I was doing Superior Court for felony charges of drug and alcohol and drunk driving charges. I had an ex-wife that came out and was looking for 7 years of back child support. I had a couple of loan sharks that were looking to do some serious damage to me. And the greatest place to hide from loan sharks, by the way, is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like there's garlic and they are vampires. They will not come in the door. It's awesome. So once I got in that meeting, I knew I was safe, And I wasn't having any of this stuff. If I sat in the back of the room and the old timer would start in the back, I was so nervous. I couldn't say, I'm Tommy T, I'm an alcoholic. I would get up and leave the meeting or go to the bathroom. 35 years old at that point. I was working out 5 days a week because I thought I was going to go to jail. I was a big guy, in good shape, and I was afraid of everything and everybody. It's a horrible place to live. Horrible place to live. Try to throw your chest out when the girl walks by, and meanwhile you're inside crying. Crying because your life is such a mess. But I got to tell you, I did not get right into the 12 steps. I did not get a sponsor right away. I was in intensive outpatient programs. And it was 5 nights a week, and then the other nights or the other weekends I had to do side jobs to try to make money. I had to pay lawyers off. I had to go places like court appearances and different things, different hoops they wanted. I had to wear a beeper. I was in a treatment against street crime, and if they beeped you, you had an hour to go give a sample. You got to be there in an hour, so you got to go tell your boss, I got to go give a sample. Just a great way to live. But it kept me busy and it kept me out of trouble. And it gave me purpose to do something to think. But all the while, I'm saying in my head, once I get off probation, once I beat these charges, I can go back. It'll be different this time. You don't understand. But something happened here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some old-timers started surrounding me, and they just friended me, and they gave me what they had. And what they had was the fellowship. They were not step big book guys on Staten Island in 1995. They were just good people. And I love it when somebody starts bashing the fellowship because that's the guy I'm going to take outside after the meeting and talk to him about the three sides of our triangle. Yeah, the steps are great. Service is great. But the fellowship is what made me so attractive to you folks. That these men would take me to a diner and sit for 3 and 4 hours and listen to my nonsense. You know the dump we do, like everybody, you don't understand. They're like, yeah, we get it. Have a burger, But they sat and they listened. They got me involved in the fellowship in sober golf, and we played some sober softball, and they encouraged me to go to the sober dances and, practice that 13th step with the best of my inability back then. But I got really involved with the fellowship and things like that, and things were going along pretty good, and my life started to get better just on the one side of the triangle. But I got to tell you, when I wasn't with you folks, those other 22 hours of the day, brutal. Brutal. When you said to me, one day at a time, it was like doing jail time. You mean I got to feel like this the rest of my life? So when I hear somebody say, one day at a time, I run over to that newcomer now and I say, no, it gets better. It's not like it is right now, because I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. How do you quiet the noises in your head? How do you feel good about yourself? How do you forget all those terrible things that you did? I can't not drink. You don't understand. No, they understood. They understood. So I'm working in this job, and I get the opportunity for a promotion, and this guy George was talking to me a little bit about, we in AA, we stand up for what we've done in the past. He said, you can stay where you are, Tom. You got a great job. Well, you can go for the promotion. List all the arrests you have and, you know, let God take over. I said, okay, that sounds good. So I listed all my arrests, and God fired me, you know. You know, we live our lives forward. But my experience here in Alcoholics Anonymous is I don't see things until 6 months after it's happened. And I know exactly why I got fired then. I got fired there because I was too hung up on the material things. I was too hung up on the pretty young girls with less than a year. And, you know, the newcomer girls just, they did something to me back then. It was crazy. And my focus was so screwed up, and it was anything about helping others. It was anything about spiritual growth. It was nothing about my recovery. It was about one day at a time and making money, and that was it. So God solved that for me. He took the job away from me. And he put me in a place in an emotional turmoil that made me seek out somebody with an answer here. And this guy, George, ended up being that guy. And when they found out I got fired, they really stepped up. They said, Tom, you want to play golf today? I'm going, I said, come on, fellas. I got no money. I got fired. Don't you understand? And they said, we didn't ask you for your bank statement. We asked you if you wanted to play golf. God's buying. We're picking you up. And they took me out there. And these tricky old guys, they know they got me for 5 hours now. I'm a captive audience. And these guys were like the ninjas of 12-step. So I'd be looking for a ball. Oh, let me help you with that. You know, really, have we seen a person fail who was thoroughly followed off? Yeah. And they start hitting me with little quotes from the book, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? I never saw these guys coming. They were stealth mode all the way. But then George got me another day on the golf course, and he said, Tom, I'm worried about you. It looks like you're going to drink. I said, it's either that or I'm going to kill myself, George. I'm thinking about it all the time. The only time I feel good is when I'm with you. And he says, well, I just had an experience in a step workshop, and I'm willing to share it with you if you're willing to come to my house once a week. He says, I promise you. Now, nobody has ever promised me anything here in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I promise you, you never have to feel the way you do today, ever again. It's up to you. Can you come to my house with enough honesty and willingness? He said, I'll cook dinner. We're going to read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I don't have a program. I'm not going to tell you anything that's not in that book. I follow the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It works very well. Are you willing to come one night a week and read? I'll make dinner, and then I'm going to give you a tape to reinforce what we read. I heard free dinner. I was unemployed. I said, I'm in. And I started to have an instant first-step experience and identification with Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the first time in 18 months now, I'm sober 18 months at this point, that I'm actually doing something for my recovery. I'm actually making it to George's house on time. And, you know, if you were like me, you didn't actually have to be drunk to get the relief of drinking. If I had my paycheck in my pocket and I was going to the bar, I felt better. If I was making that call for a substance, I felt better because I knew I was going to get relief. I had that experience driving to George's house. It's Wednesday. I'm going to George's. This was a 5'4", bald-headed bookie from Brooklyn, and he just made me feel okay, you know. We started to read the tape we were using was a Joe Hawk tape from a Salvation Army talk he did in a big book workshop he did in California, and it was just awesome. I highly recommend the tape to anybody that's going through the 12 steps. He really simplified things and made it really easy for a guy like me who didn't want to do anything for my own recovery. He kind of just walked me through it. Because if you start barking orders at me, I'm going the other way. I'm not. You can't be a hard step Nazi with me. You just can't do it. I'm not going to respond to that. But when you tell me, look, I'm not telling you to do this. The book is telling you to do this. They're suggesting it. And then they slip in those, you know, it's suggested to use a parachute if you jump out of a plane, right? You know, all those subtle, old, corny lines. But that's what helped me. That was my experience. I remember reading the doctor's opinion and my jaw dropped open. And George said, what's the matter? I said, I can't believe they wrote this book about me in 1939. So all those good people that I talked to you about before that tried to reach me and tell me what was going on, but they did it from a book, now I have an alcoholic reading to me, and it's hitting my heart. A phenomenon of craving, a mental obsession. Oh, my God, that's why I keep doing the same thing. And then he got me with the agnostics, and we talked about page 52, and that spiritual malady. Was I having trouble with personal relations? Pray to misery and ding, 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 ding. I'm hitting off on all cylinders here. I'm a mess. I'm 18 months removed from alcohol and drugs, and I'm 9 for 9 in the questions on page 52. I'm a mess. I am not a God person. I was not a God person. That conjured up childhood memories that weren't too fond, and a feeling of coming up short and not being worthy. And George got me through step two, and we the agnostics, on a willingness to believe. And I had that willingness because I knew for a fact, 23 years of my experience, even 35 years of my experience, because before drinking, I was not succeeding in life. I was willing to believe because my life was horrible. And I believed that George believed. He was too goofy not to believe. The stupid stuff that would come out of this guy's mouth, he had to have a God thing going on. You know, so in the third step, we knelt down on a cold tile floor. I held his hands, and I didn't know what was going on. I probably still don't know what was going on today. But I'll tell you, I started to change. The biggest change in my third step was I got off that floor, and I couldn't wait to write a fourth step. I wrote my first fourth step in 9 days. I was fired. I had nothing to do. I woke up, made sure I had 2 packs of Marlboros, a couple pots of coffee, and I was zinging through that. Red Bull's got nothing on good Starbucks, I'm telling you. And so 9 days, I wrote down quite a few. We were pretty thorough back then because we were doing a lot of the mechanical work. And I wrote it out, and he made it so easy. You know, we just did the columns. You know, we wrote about fear, and I went to him and spoke to him about fear a little bit, and I said, couldn't I just done a lot less writing and just told you I'm afraid of everything and anybody. I mean, I'm a 37-year-old man at that point, really built pretty well, going to the gym 5 days a week. I got a fear of salespeople. Come on. This is crazy. Fear of public speaking, fear of success, fear of failure, fear of not being good enough, fear of being too good. I mean, I'm like, what is this? This is crazy. Don't worry about it. He said, don't worry about it. We wrote it all down. Then we wrote a relationship inventory, or a sex inventory, as they call it, and I was actually the guy that would tell you, I don't know what it is. I'm always drawn to the crazy ones. Just bad luck. I can't seem to get a year with any one girl. I got to bounce from one to another, you know? I believed that nonsense. It's not really that funny when you think about it. And then it was pointed out to be in a kind and loving way that, what's the common denominator there, Tom? And I realized that I treated women as conquests, possessions, not equal, didn't need to be your friend. I'd sleep with you and then see if I liked you. It was horrible. It was horrible. The things that I did, the ways that I manipulated women my whole life, I wasn't a nice guy. I would have told you that before I did that inventory. Oh, yeah, no, I open car doors. I buy dinners. I don't hit women. I'm good. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm going to do what it takes to get you to do what I want you to do, and then I'm going to run away from you because I can't let you inside. Because if you knew the real me, you wouldn't like me, and I can't handle that. And that's the truth. So we went to a fifth step, and we had this great place on Staten Island. It was Mount Manresa. Big spiritual mountain and a grotto and everything, and we went there to do a fifth step, and about 75 steps up to the top of the mountain, and I get there and George is already there. I have to meet him up on top, and I pull out my couple of books I had, and I just, you know, those deep dark secrets, those 3 pages, running out on your kids, stealing money from my grandmother when she was dying of cancer, the abortions, the adopted kid, all the stuff that I'm taking to my grave. The transvestites, that ain't going to be shared about. I rip those pages out. I throw it under the seat. He don't need to know that. I'll share that with a priest. They're safe. And I go up on the mountain, and I do a couple hours with George. And George says to me, Tom, you're doing great work, man. I see a change in you. He said the 12 and 12 now tells you that you're going to start to have a spiritual experience, and you're going to start to become one with God and his men. I said, well, that's all good. I appreciate it, George. Meanwhile, in my head, I know I got those 3 pages down there. So he says, listen, I just want to tell you, if you've left anything out, leave it here on the mountain. If you remember something, give me a call later. He says, because you're going to wipe out everything that you've done up to this point. And I said, no, that's it, George. I'm good. This is good. And I start walking down those stairs. And George don't leave the mountain. And I'm like, share it, don't share it, share it, don't share it. I got the 8-year-old and the devil going the whole way down, and felt like it took forever to get down those stairs. I sit in my car, I start that car, and it felt like I had a flame underneath my seat. It got very warm. I took a deep breath. I shut the car off. I grabbed the papers. I opened the door. I said, George, wait up. And he went. The old timers, right? They know us better than we know ourselves. So I shared those things, and there's something that I do with young men that share their fifth steps, that think they're the worst. I thought I was the worst. George did a little thing with me that I do with the men now. He had a little comment for over almost every one of my top 30 that will just made me feel like less than. And he would say things like, yeah, those things don't work out when we do them. We do them. He said, yeah, that kind of nonsense never helps anybody, never helps our family. But there's a way to get past that. And then he would say things like, that sounds like fun. I never got to do that, you know. And he lightened it up. But then the miracle of that was he hugged me. And he said, so tomorrow, my house, 6 and 7, I'm cooking pasta. I was amazed. See, because I would tell the thieves about my thieving. I would tell the womanizers about that. I would tell the gamblers about my gambling. But no one person on this earth knew all about Tom T. And this guy did it. He still embraced me and still invited me back to his home. I was amazed by that. When I went home that night, I put my head down on the pillow. Silence. I got the best 6 hours of sleep I've ever gotten. I've woken up with an energy that I don't think has left me to this day. I mean, I've been through the first 9 steps many times since then, but that first experience, it quieted the chatter of 1,000 monkeys that has always been in my head. And I went, and we did 6 and 7, and we talked about my character defects, and we talked about asking God to remove them, and I prayed that 7-step prayer every single day. And a quick story about my home group. I'm there on a 20-year resentment. I'm still there. We went down there right after I did my 7th step. And it was a 7-step meeting. They read from the 12 and 12, and they talked about lust for 35 minutes. One of the 7 deadly sins. Oh. And I said, they're not even saying the prayer. He said, shut up. I said, George, they know nothing about the big book here. He said, shut up. He said, put your hand up and share or shut up. I raised my hand with a burning desire. I stood up and I recited my creator. I am now willing that you have all of me, good and bad. And I gave him my brand of spirituality, right? Guys in the room with 25 years looking at me like, what's going on with this kid? He was going to kill himself 2 weeks ago, you know? And we go outside, and George, and this is the kind of sponsorship I've been blessed to have. George says to me, you don't like the way this group's going? Why don't you become a member? Why don't you bring the 12 steps down here the way that you think they should be brought down here, with the big book? I did it out of resentment for him, too. Well, show him. I've been there for 20 years. We talk about the big book. It's a great home group. It's pretty awesome. So we went into 8 and 9, and I got paralyzed in fear because I was a big thief, as well as all the other things that I did. But it was told to me, quite frankly, you got to make all your amends. So they got to be face-to-face. We didn't have Facebook. We didn't text. Basically, not a lot of people had emails back then. So it was about knocking on doors. And I was petrified to do so. And I balked. Within less than 2 weeks, I got so spiritually sick that I was obsessing and drank almost every day. 2 weeks. All this work we've done for a couple of months, 2 weeks, shot to hell. I'm standing there outside of the Randall Manor meeting on Thursday night. And a guy comes over to me and says, he's a mailman, Bobby. He says, hey, Tommy, I heard you're doing the 12 steps with George. Would you share at our step group this Saturday? I said, of course I will. I'm good A. I'm good AA. I'll be there. He said, well, we start at 5:30. This week we're doing step 9. And I went, well, listen, I got a list, but I haven't made any amends yet, so I'll have to pass. Maybe you get me next time around. He says, no. You got 3 days. He pats me on the back. He says, make a few amends. Let us know how they turn out. And he walked away. He walked away. Spiritual pride, fear of being judged badly, probably the latter. I did what the book told me. I called my sponsor, and I tried to explain to my parents and to my sister and clear the wreckage with my family and tell them how I'm looking at life nowadays a little differently. I had a wonderful experience with my mother. Mothers are just the best. The best. My father I made in a bar because I couldn't get him at a sober moment. Wasn't the greatest experience, but it was very powerful in the long scheme of things, the way that relationship healed. I made an amends with my sister, and somehow I became the big brother. She's older than I am, but I don't know how that works. But I had a letter I had to write to my grandmother, who I stole money from when she was dying of cancer, and I lied to her, and that was the last time I saw her. And I was so embarrassed and ashamed that I couldn't go to where she was buried. I went to the wake. I faked it through the wake. I was 16 at the time. But I couldn't bring myself to go to the funeral. And see, Grandma was the one that, when my father was on a tear and he was smacking the kids around or smacking my mother around, my mother would scoop us up in blankets and take us to Grandma's house. And if you crossed that threshold and smelt mothballs, you were safe. None of my grandmother's four alcoholic sons would dare come to her house and disrespect her being drunk in her home. So when we got there, we were safe. Grandma had a little shoebox for me. It had a black and white cop car in it, I think a paper clip, a piece of string, and a rubber band. I was happy as hell with that stuff. I mean, imagine that, no iPhone, and I was able to keep myself entertained just because I was at Grandma's. But I lied to her, and I stole from her. And it really burnt a hole in my soul. Out of all the things that I've done in my life, this was the one. This was the one that just ripped me apart. And I didn't know where she was buried. I knew the area in a cemetery in Staten Island. The meeting was at 5 o'clock. This is about 3 o'clock. A bright sunny day. And I take this letter and I go up there and I'm going to make this amends before I go down and speak. And I don't know where she's buried. And I'm walking up and down rows. And I'm almost ready to give up. It's about 3:45. And I said, no, I better get down to the meeting. So I'm way back, and I walk on a diagonal back to my car, and I walk right into my grandmother's stone. It was right where I parked my car. And, like, the hair on my neck stood up. I took a deep breath, and I took this letter out. It was very brief. My sponsor had me be very brief. He was not all about this perfect approach and all this stuff. Let it come from the heart. And I can read fairly well. I couldn't get these words out. I stood there and I started to cry like somebody cries when something's taken away from them as a kid. And all I had to say was, Grandma, I'm so sorry that I turned out to be the kid that you saw before you passed away. Thank you for everything you did to me. I wish I could have been a better grandson to you. I couldn't get those words out. I stopped crying. I got in the car. I don't remember going to the car. I don't remember driving to the meeting. I stared at a beeper and shared on my experience with my four amends. And I remember that there was about 15 AAs that came up to me that had now known me for a while and said, buddy, I don't know what you're doing different, but don't stop. You are a different man. Just keep going. Keep going. And I can tell you now, pointing back to that, that's the day that my outlook on life changed. I stopped being a victim that day. And I know that I can make things right for even that to a dead person. How can I do that? By helping others. My grandmother was a very religious person, would open her doors to anybody. I open my doors to anybody now. My grandmother would be proud to see the man that you see here today. It's taken me a long time to get past that. I was still fired at the time, and my sponsor said, Tom, don't you owe the Department of Education an amends? And I said, well, George, I'd really like to wait until my case is settled. And he said, well, I don't think you should. You've been manipulating things your whole life, and it hasn't been turning out that well. Why don't you put your career in God's hands and see what he can do for you? Really, George? Corny old bastard, I'm telling you. But I went to this guy, CEO of the Division of School Facilities, and he saw me, and I made an approach, and I talked to him. I said, Jim, I'm doing good right now. He said, I heard. I heard you coming up on a couple of years sober. That's great. And I said, well, that's why I'm here. I need to talk to you about the interview after my arrest. I said, about the only thing I told you that was the truth was my name. He said, well, I kind of figured you were drunk, Tom. He said, I kind of figured it was your handgun. I said, no, Jimmy, it goes a lot deeper than that. I said, in the 17 years I worked for you, I stole time from you. I was hungover on the job. I was drunk on the job. I punched other employees out on the job. I stole tools from the job. I said, there's no way I could even tally up what I've taken from the Department of Education, being a horrible employee and an active alcoholic on this job. And he kind of tilted his head to the side and he said, "That's interesting, Tom." I said, "It probably took you a lot of guts to come up here." I said, "Guts got nothing to do with it, Jim. If I don't do this stuff, my sponsor tells me I'm never going to be free of this, and I got to get free of this, or I'm going to kill myself." And he said, "You know, I'm a deacon in my church. I'm a big shot upstate." Said, "That's nice." He said, "Mine was alcohol too." He said, "We don't find God because things are good." He said, "I bottomed out in alcohol, and I was losing my wife, so I just went to the church. I never made it to AA, but I heard they do great things there. Keep doing what you're doing." He said, "I'm not the decision maker on your case, but I wish you luck. And as far as what you can do to make it right, let's wait and see what the department says." I said, "Okay." So I walked out. It was great amends. I didn't get thrown through the plate glass window that I had in my head that that was going to happen. He didn't ask me for anything, so it was pretty cool. So about 10 days later, I get summoned to the last of the arbitration cases, and I go in, and they pounded me on the stand for 2 hours. In that week, I celebrated 2 years, and I had my two-year coin. And, you know, if you're sitting here today and you don't have a sponsor, please get one. Their emotions aren't attached to our problems. They can see things so much clearly, more clearly. And my sponsor prepared me for everything that I had to go through. And he gave me a line to talk to them about. And he said, "When you get nervous, just rub your coin in your pocket. You're going to get nervous." And I was nervous. And they asked me all these questions, and I'm trying to be honest, but my honest answer is, I don't remember. I was in a blackout. I don't have that detail for you. I wish I could tell you. I was really, really drunk. I was out for 2 days. I went through and through it. And the last question was, "Mr. Tarackle, are you going to sit here and tell us today that you have not ingested any alcohol or any drugs since April 8th, 1995? Sponsor's line. I pull out my coin. I said, "Listen, fellas, I've tried to be as honest as I can. I said, you've already taken my job. I got nothing to lose here. I said, but you're not going to take this coin from me, and I'm going to walk out of here with my integrity." And with that, the arbitrator gives me a wink. I'm like, what's up with this? You know, I don't know if he was one of us, whether he was gay. I don't know what the hell was going on. But we go out. And they said, "Thank you very much," and we went out. We come back in like 4 minutes. That's how long the deliberation was. All we were asking for was my old job back, not the promotion that I was going for. They come back and they said, "Mr. Tarackle, we're very impressed with your honesty here today and the way you held up for yourself. You know, although you've done some bad things off the job, we don't see that it's really bled into the Department of Education. Once you got arrested, you did tell everybody that what happened, and I was manipulating everybody. Let's not make it like I was a saint. I was not in AA yet. But I made all the right announcements, and I told everybody. I made every appointment because my sponsor told me to make every appointment. I filled out every deposition because my sponsor helped me fill out those depositions. I went to Jim Lonergan, the CEO, because my sponsor told me to go to Jim Lonergan. I didn't do this on my own." So they say, "Well, we're going to give you your job back." I said, "Oh, okay." I said, "And if you keep your nose clean for a year, we're going to give you that shot at the promotion." Wow, we weren't asking for that. And then he says, "And we're going to give you your back pay. We're going to give you a check for $17,000. You'll be able to get it as you picked up, as you go out." I said, "Really? You know anybody that's gone through the 12 steps for 17 grand? I'm your guy. So fast forward, I go back to Jim Lonergan, and he says, "Congratulations, I heard you got your job back." He said, "Stay clean for a year. I'll get a job for you." He gave me a job, and I became his most trusted employee. I got placed for a tie in a job with a man with similar experience and licensing as I had in the engineering field. But the job was prone to bribes because it was working with a lot of mob contractors. And Jimmy Lonergan broke the tie by saying, "Give it to Tarackle. If he takes a bribe, he'll drink. We'll know right away." My biggest fear turned into my biggest asset because of sponsorship. So I've been promoted every 3 years or so over the last 20 years. Jim Lonergan retired about 7 years ago. They made me that CEO. I just had a consultation for retirement. They have to pay me for the rest of my life. Where do you get this stuff? Where do you get this stuff? You get it from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you get it from folks like you, and you get it from sponsorship. I could have never came up with this. I couldn't have dreamed this scenario. And my sponsor talked to me about self-evaluation and spot check inventories in 10. That's where I live my life today. I am no longer a victim. The true freedom here in Alcoholics Anonymous is when you are no longer a victim and you are responsible for your emotional well-being, your physical health, your financial health, and nobody else can throw you off that if you're right with God. There's no other freedom like that in the world. And all those bad things that I've done in my life and all those kids that I've run out on and abortions and things like that that I've done, I'm doing the best I can right now. I married my best friend here in Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years ago down at the Atlantic Convention. She's in the front row, my wife Cheryl. She came to me with three kids, and I have a kid that has 2 years sober now. We have the greatest family in the world. Greatest family in the world. And it took me 10 years to break down our daughter. She hated me. She just hated me because I was stealing her mom from her, or that's what she thought. For 3 years, she didn't talk to me when we first dated. We've been dating for 10 years. Cheryl's got 11. We're dating for 10. Please do the math. All right. None of this get them on their back before they get on their feet kind of stuff going on in my home group. So, bad joke, I know. But Callie wouldn't talk to me for 3 years. Then she went through the teen years, and she just became the nastiest young lady you ever want to see. And my sponsor would give me lines like, "I'm sorry you're having a bad day, Callie. It's a shame you feel you need to talk to me that way in front of your friends." And I did it over and over and over again. And she was just testing me to see if I'd become that loudmouth, enraged guy that she knows. And I never did. She went through some tough times. I stood by her side. She came out of like depression and anxiety. She's now attending University of Alabama, Roll Tide. We saw my friend over there. And me and her are just great friends now. And when she hangs up the phone, she tells me, "I love you." And I love her too. Our boy's in the service. He's having a baby. He just wrote me a 2-page letter that would rip your heart out. He says, "I'm afraid of being a father. I'm afraid of being a dad. I've tried to hang on to what my father should be, and I haven't looked at what's right in front of me. I have the best example of a dad for the last 10 years, and that's you, Tom. I need your help." Where do you get this stuff? You don't get it anywhere here but Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm married to my best friend. So those 20 or so women, I'm trying to make it up with Cheryl. And I fall short a lot. But I have a sponsor to kick me in the pants and get me going. I have a home group that I would not trade for anything. I'm very impressed with the home group here, the organization of it, and the service structure. You come to Decker Avenue Step. If you're in New York City and you make a wrong turn and end up on Staten Island, you come see us, and you'll get a warm handshake, a real bad cup of coffee. But if you're struggling with anything, you're not going to leave without a sponsor. And if you stay with us, you're going to go through the 12 steps and the traditions. You're going to get into the service structure because that's what we do here. That's what we do here. One drunk at a time, we teach each other how to live successfully in this world. And that's what I've been given here, and it's the greatest gift in all. I thank you all for inviting me up here and for my life. God bless.